Summer Tan Debt. Written by Silent Walrus. Read by Opal Song. Fandom, Full Metal Alchemist. Rating, teen. Relationship, Ed Roy. Also tagged for hair braiding, fancy party, love confessions, grief or mourning. That's unrelated to the love confessions, BTW. That's a whole separate problem entirely. Misunderstandings. Roy Mustang. Yeah, I low-key hate myself, LMAO. No, it doesn't affect my daily life or relationships at all. Why do you ask? Part 12 of Caveat Emptor.
You got those lips that make me scream. Two arms that hold my fate and hands that turn my nightmares into dreams. You got those eyes that make me mean. A face that tells a story hidden somewhere in a magazine.
No inhibitions, don't like restrictions. You're a part-time lover, hiding undercover.
Chapter 1. Mustang refuses to confirm or deny about the mob thing, which would be a confirmation in and of itself, except for how Ed genuinely can't tell whether it's just because Mustang's enjoying fucking with him about it. Good grief, this is why you're so blasé about getting the firing squad, Ed swears, and Scar coming after you for baby daddy rumors. And Armstrong filleting you for baby mama rumors. They'll have to wait for the fucking mob to get done turning your kneecaps inside out first.
It's good to prioritize. Mustang agrees, noncommittal.
For fuck's sake, no wonder you wanted a bitch who can take a gunfight. If they come after me, Mustang, they're the ones who'll get in line. Because you better believe I'll get your kneecaps first. Mustang laughs him off, which is exactly the kind of behavior that gets one mixed up with the mob in the first place. So Ed lets it be known he doesn't want to hear shit from him about risk-reward calculations ever again, and makes himself and Hawkeye a big batch of commiseration meatballs. He makes them in Mustang's kitchen, because at this point, his own fridge now looks depressingly like Mustang's did at the start of all this shit. Though the look of dismay on Mustang's face when he exits his office and finds Ed packing the food up instead of plating it makes it worth it. The dismay changes into more of a bemused horror when he sees the rest of the kitchen.
Tomatoes no longer hold non-combatant status around here, I see, he says. Working out some feelings, are we?
Oh, zip it, Ed grumbles. The meatballs are Date style. Sig's family recipe, so it's portioned for 30 people, and the sauce specifically demands great violence against whole tomatoes. It's not like you clean any of it yourself, the fuck you want, cause it's not food you're getting.
The Cretan embassy's throwing a party,
Mustang says, tapping a piece of cardstock that looks too fancy to even send through the mail against his palm.
You're specified.
Great, Ed says, looking sauce off the edge of his hand. What's it mean?
Oh, it's what we wanted,
Mustang assures, showing it to Ed, then clicking his tongue and just holding it in front of him instead when Ed reaches for it with greasy fingers.
Grumman's going to be there, but he never met you, did he?
Nah, Ed frowns at the guilty paper. Most of it's in Cretan, so he doesn't know how the fuck he's specified.
But Minister of War Roy Mustang is in the middle there in calligraphed letters. Does he know I'm alive? Doesn't much care, though. If he recognizes you, well, I doubt it'll be a real problem. But probably best you take a convenient bathroom break if he heads over.
He's still fucking with you for fun, huh?
Mustang pulls a face. The delights of stewardship. He holds out a dishcloth. It's on the 10th. Dress nice.
As if Ed's not the reason Mustang even has dishcloths now. Bastard, I don't got anything nicer that isn't Jingyi's stuff, and I can't wear that. Not to an embassy party, and especially not going with Mustang, who'll probably have to show up wrapped in the Amstrian flag. And I'm not going to a tailor just for this. If they'd even be able to get it together in time for anything less than a zillion cents, what?
No, you're right.
Mustang's now dangerously evaluative look does not abate.
I'll take care of it.
Says Ed.
Relax, I'll get you something. You just stop by here early on the day.
Oh no. You are not dressing me up like some kind of Missy doll, Ed refutes.
Mustang just looks amused. I don't have Missy's budget, he says, flicking one of Ed's bracelets. And you've just told me you don't either. Luckily for both of us, I do know some places that specialize in delivering on time.
And it's just magically gonna fit? Ed demands, because most stuff without stretch always ends up crinkled in weird places on him. And nice clothes are always without stretch. Transmutation marks on cloth show more the nicer the fabric is. Even I can't refine it off all the way.
Mustang raises his eyebrows and gives Ed an obvious once-over. 16, 46, 38, 30, he says, reciting down Ed's body. Am I wrong?
Ed just stares back at him, because the only tailors that have measured him did so in Jingyi's and communicated just enough to convey he was notably below the sentience of a carved turnip. How should I know?
Mustang sighs. I suppose we'll get you to stop buying off the rack eventually. Do you have shoes?
Absolutely not, Ed threatens, which makes Mustang grin. I mean, don't buy me shoes, Mustang. Fits hard enough even without automail. I'll do it my damn self.
All right. Black leather is your friend here, at least.
Black leather's always my friend, Ed mutters, which even he knows is admitting he's lost. Fuck. Remember, the dumber you make me look, the harder I'll take it out of you after.
My sparrow, why on earth would I make you look worse?
Mustang says, like he expects a result that isn't Ed snatching up the sauce spoon and chasing him out of the kitchen. So on the day of, Ed just wears some gym stuff and gets a street pancake on the way, because lunch was a long time ago, and he's not sure if any of those Cretan words on the invite meant dinner. There's already multiple cars in Mustang's driveway when Ed walks up, which means Morrissey and Ailey and maybe a few others are here. But he's still not prepared for the level of activity he finds inside.
Good grief, it's like a sorority house in here, Ed says, aware Kojak is repinning some medals on some lieutenant in the foyer. The door to the garage is open, and Ed can hear Peters inside.
Someone's on the phone somewhere else in the house. Are y'all not allowed to dress yourselves anymore? Certain functions require us to pass inspection prior to arrival, Ailey recites from where he's standing in the corner, with his cover under his arm. The only thing that could make him look more like a stuffed training dummy is if he were facing the wall. It's more expedient for the motorcade to depart en masse from one location.
You don't get paid enough, Ed decides.
A fucking men, Morrissey mutters as Ed passes him in the hall. Mustang's in the kitchen, sitting in a starched shirt and extremely shiny shoes,
the jacket of his dress uniform sprawled across his knees like a scarecrow's corpse. He's got a needle and thread in hand, a surprisingly robust sewing kit open on the table next to his ceremonial saber, and his cover. "What, accidentally pop a stitch with your special boy sword?" Ed says. "Har har," Mustang says, then actually looks up. He frowns. "Did you make that out of a tablecloth?" "What? Oh." Ed has to glance down before he realizes Mustang's talking about his gym shorts, which he's had since he was 17 and were cast-offs to begin with from Care Sean, who lived on the other side of the Rockabells. "Of course it's not a fucking tablecloth. Who makes shorts out of a tablecloth? It's probably curtains."
"Probably?"
"I don't know. I didn't make them."
"So they're not even your shorts?"
"They are now." "What the hell are you wearing?" The goddamn comms director says from behind Ed, where they've got their entire team with them. "Why are they here?" Ed demands of Mustang, pointing the last of his pancake at the comms contingent.
"It's a major social function,"
Mustang says, still frowning, now at Ed's shoes, which are just the same sandals he's been wearing all summer, and aren't even coming apart yet or anything, so he doesn't know what the problem here is.
"There'll be quite a bit of press present."
"No, really," the director says. "Mustang, it's been weeks. Why does he still look like a goat herd?"
"He's changing here," Mustang says,
standing up and laying his sewing project aside to beckon Ed into the laundry room. Ed's only been in here once, because Mustang doesn't do his own laundry, has fuck all in the way of cleaning soap, and Ed managed to get the worst of the mustard off chowder with the backyard hose anyway. But there is an inbuilt ironing board. And Mustang lifts a heavy shopping bag off that and hands it to Ed.
"Got your shoes?"
Ed hefts up his own bag, which is really just his grocery sack, and contains the most boot-like shoes he can get away with. Mustang's bag contains a stack of flat boxes, and the boxes contain clothes, pants, and shirt, dark and light. And for a second, Ed thinks it's some kind of tux standard before he realizes the pants are just very dark blue, the exact color of the Amstrian dress uniform. "Oh, come on," Ed complains, but Mustang's already slipped back out into the kitchen. "Ugh." Ed strips off, grumbling, but at least there's absolutely no danger here of sentimentality. The fabrics, some are light and clearly well-made, the pants loose enough to be comfortable, and the shirt's a white button-up whose only distinguishing feature seems to be the rounded collar, until Ed sees the embroidery on the cuffs. It's little skulls. Embroidered white on white, so you can only see it if you're up close. People don't usually encourage Ed, especially not in this. Primarily because he really, really doesn't need it, but... Up until 5 seconds ago, Ed would have said Mustang hated his spikes and crossbones shit as much as everyone else does. This might say otherwise. It's not even to draw attention to him, to make Ed stand out, because you really can't see it much. Realistically, the only people who are going to see this is Ed and Mustang himself. Mustang, who gave this to him. It's more of what he's been doing. Those smiles that can be read two ways, inviting Ed to share the joke. For a second, the urge to rip the shirt off is overwhelming. Ed presses his mouth flat. He shoves his shoes on, lifts his hair out of his collar, and gets a fucking grip. Mustang means well, probably. Doesn't see a difference between this and the Amstrian blue pants, probably. It's fine. Ed rolls up the sleeves and exits the laundry room. It won't be weird to pretend he just didn't see it. There's a comforting level of noise in the kitchen, where Mustang's back to his sewing and the director's back to haranguing.
And don't just hole up with Kakadia again for 3 hours. They'll accuse you of infidelity this time, on top of treason against the state. We were talking about fruit imports, Mustang says, briefly sticking the needle in his mouth to adjust a fold. Her future husband was there the whole time. You think they won't say you're fucking him too? Not when the Cretians are so much more famously discerning than us on the subject. No. Mustang ties off the knot, snaps the thread with his teeth, and stands to lay the jacket next to the saber, giving Ed a once-over in the process. There, much better, he says approvingly, only to, of course, then segue into another frown. Is that how you're doing your hair? Ed isn't doing anything with his hair at all, since leaving it down is as formal as he gets.
What the fuck's wrong with my hair?
It's a bit anarchist for this kind of evening, Mustang says critically. Behind him, the director throws up their hands and leaves the room. Put it up again. Any of those braids you did last spring will do.
Those were a one-time-only menu item, pal, Ed retorts. You think I did those myself?
Then I'll do it, Mustang says, standing up. Come here, sit.
Oh, no. You are not touching my hair, Ed says, more desperately than he'd like.
Don't be silly. I do Alicia's. I've told you. I know what I'm doing, Mustang says impatiently. Sit down. We have 10 minutes.
For a critical second, Ed's rage and his pants raccoon have each other by the throat, which locks him up just long enough for Mustang to exert force onto his shoulders and thunk him into a chair. Mustang's got the little comb he keeps in his pocket in hand, and then he sectioned Ed's hair surprisingly quickly and starts what feels like a high braid. Ed decides that whatever is happening to his scalp right now is none of his business, and what's more, that his vocal cords can stay glued. Luckily, there's no space for anyone to notice he's gone mute, because the comms director barges back in, barks, last-minute guest list additions, and starts reciting names. Ed, with relief, starts paying real attention after he recognizes 2 names from the Xingyi's embassy staff, which means there's going to be an official Xingyi's presence at the party, which means his evening activities just got decided in the form of making sure Ling's goddamn cousin doesn't see, hear, smell, or psychically intuit any hint of Ed. Fuck, it's too late. There's absolutely no way this info hasn't gotten back to the Yao already. They're definitely keeping tabs on Mustang, and absolutely not neglecting what he's sticking his dick into. Well, at least Ling is gonna know right away it's a front, so Ed can probably expect some kind of lavish congratulatory gift of matrimonial variety in the mail sometime soon. The Emperor of Xing has to get his jollies somehow. That carries him through to Mustang tying off what feels like 2 braids, sending Ed up with an all-done pat on his shoulder, all while arguing with the director over how much treason it should look like he's doing with the Cretians. Ed reflexively drags a hand over the results, goes to the hall mirror, stops short. Mustang gave him boxer braids. Good ones. Tight enough that Ed could actually take a mat if he wanted, passing any referee check. It's what he'd give himself if he could. The 2 braids ridge his head and go down over his shoulders, on either side of the high shirt collar. The shirt with skulls rolled up tight, burning brands into Ed's forearms. With the white linen and all the hair out of his face, he looks cleaner. More in focus, makes it easy to see how unhappy he looks. Mustang just can't fucking make anything easy, can he? Just when you want to write him off as a complete bastard, he goes and gives a shit. And Ed has no fucking right to be furious, because he's been saying yes the whole way. There's no reason for Mustang to think this would make things worse, because Ed hasn't been giving him one. And there's no fucking need to give him one, Because that's what not any of this is even about. Ed thinks savagely at himself, leaving the mirror. What did he think was going to happen here? Mustang to say, oops, I'm so sorry, let me eat you out while I'm at it? It's Ed's fucking problem, and the faster he hurries up and gets his shit together and stops having this problem, the sooner he can go back to having other shit, like braids and normal goddamn relationships and shirts with skulls on them. Mustang's finished whatever the fuck he was doing in the kitchen. Saber on his belt, metals clanking as he shoulders on his dress jacket. Ed, not for the first time, sort of apathetically wishes he had some sort of uniform kink, if only out of sheer practicality. As it is, Mustang just looks overdone.
Are we ready?
He says imperiously, like he didn't just spend 20 minutes retailoring his own outfit. When you are, Hawkeye says from behind them, which has Ed spinning around and his mood improving significantly, even if she does have the rest of the soldiers behind her. They're all in dress uniform, all sabered up at the hip, which is not actually much of a contrast with the director and their flock of all dark suits with honest-to-God radios on their belts. Ed's the one who stands out. The white shirt's like a beacon in this crowd. And with Hawkeye in heels, he's once again the shortest person in the room. It makes him feel a half-step off in a way he thought he'd grown out of. A way that shouldn't matter to him anymore. And it's only reinforced by the glimpse of himself he catches among them as they troop past the hallway mirror. With his bangs back, he looks even younger. Not offset enough by the scar across his forehead. Some shit-ass kid, about as needed and welcome here as a sex doll in a fishing net. But it's not like there's a place for him at some fucking university either. Ed sets his teeth against it and focuses on the moment, on the drive down Arsenal West with the earliest solstice decorations already starting to get put up. The Cretan Embassy is one of the biggest complexes on Embassy Row, distinguished further by all the terraces and tiers of archways and minarets the Cretans keep adding to compete with the regularly expanding Xingyi's embassy just across the road. There's an entrance line set up, cars crawling through around the fountain out front. And as they all pile out of the motorcade, Mustang offers his elbow, which Ed has no choice but to take as Hawkeye and the rest form up around them. It makes Ed mad all over again. The thoughtless ease with which Mustang does it. The expectation that Ed will just take it. So Ed twists his own arm and makes his grip slide until they're hand in hand, squeezing hard and the only bite back he's got. It's a stupid fucking thing to do. Because you can kick Mustang in the balls and not get a reaction when he's got his public face on, smiling and gliding them up the line of the Cretan security. And now Ed has to stop himself from compulsively rubbing his thumb to see if he can feel Mustang's scar through the glove. Because his fucking pants raccoon never cares how pissed he is and gives him the self-control of an addict. It's almost a relief when Mustang has to let go to pass them through security. Even though the check itself is a joke, Mustang's got his gloves on, arrays as bright as blood, and Hawkeye and the rest get waved through without even having to unholster their pistols for inspection. Presumably the threat of starting a war is enough of a deterrent. The entrance hall they end up in is a combination security and staging area, full of knots of people and a lot of loud crashing and clinking. There's a separate aisle surrounded by photographers, cameras going off constantly. No reporters, photographs only, the comms director is telling Mustang in dire tones, pointing at it. All right, go. This makes Mustang retake Ed's elbow, this time tucking his arm close to his chest in a way that precludes any wriggling. The fuck's this for?
Society papers, Mustang says, steering them right into it. Smile.
Ugh, Ed says. And then they're in the flashbulb corridor. His eyes water immediately, making him blink hard as the world turns into afterimages, and the flashes just keep going off. If people want a goddamn photo of him, it shouldn't be him physically inconvenienced by it. Then it registers that Mustang slightly adjusted the angle of his body and his grip. It's not a lot, but it alters how they're walking in an odd little way Ed can't place, though. Oh, you can't see shit right now, can you?
Give it a second.
Mustang doesn't give any other indication of disorientation. Just keeps smiling genially and using Ed's body as a rudder. It's the first sign Ed's seen besides the glasses that Mustang's de-blindening had any side effects. But then again, it's not really surprising. Even if whatever was taken got alchemically restored, it's still not seamless. Ask Ed's right shoulder! So he steers Mustang out of the corridor and into the embassy courtyard, which is milling with people, but mostly focused all on one thing. A massive hexagonal hole opened up in the floor. The ground beneath sunk deep, a miniature jungle mountain rising up out of it, complete with live plants and burbling waterfalls and birds in hallucinatory colors. It's really fucking cool, actually. The whole crowd is murmuring in appreciation. Everybody circling around it, pointing and exclaiming when a tiny orange monkey vaults out of a crevice and goes scampering up a vine. There are golden lanterns tucked strategically among the rocks and plants, lighting blooms of dense tropical flowers, the whole thing looking like a three-dimensional fairy tale. There's even fish in here. The bottom of the hole contains a moat. And more floating lanterns pick out glints of gold and silver scales, flashes of blue and red and green in between thick, verdant lily pads. Absolutely nobody is paying attention to Mustang discreetly blinking himself back to rights at Ed's shoulder.
Oh, this is new,
Mustang says a second later, which Ed takes to mean he can see again.
Last time they made a scale replica of the Mahan Sundar Mahal out of marzipan.
What? When was that? Did you get to eat it?
Half a window pane, yes.
And you didn't take me? Ed demands, outraged.
Mustang gives him an amused look. Sugar meant to stay in shape through 6 hours of pipe smoke party does not taste like you want it to, darling.
You could have let me decide that for myself, Ed says darkly.
It was before our relationship, starling. I promise the next time someone tries to feed me a national monument, I will, at the very least, save you a piece.
Whatever. This is cool too, I guess. Ed sulks. Though Ling's birthday had had little sugar and fruit dragons and phoenixes everywhere, and those tasted great. But his mood is improving. Seeing these lights. He wouldn't have seen this cool indoor mountain thing if he hadn't been doing this bullshit with Mustang. And it's a really elaborate project, the kind of thing it'd take solving a lot of interlocking fiddly problems to achieve. They clearly got alchemists in to create it. The rises of stone are too smooth, and the embedded railings too seamlessly joined for it to be manual construction. Is this a good sign? Ed says to Mustang, tapping his hands on where a welding seam should be on a traditionally made railing. Krita's not one of the countries that's totally anti-alchemy like Arugo or Ishval, but they've got a lot of religions there, and in general, that's the kind of crowd that frowns on miracles of the non-divine sort. Plus, the whole international outcry from a bunch of countries post-Promise Day demanding Amstrad curb alchemy usage entirely. Not that they could do shit about it. If their embassy's hiring alchemists, especially Amstrian ones, to terraform their party pieces, however, that's sending a kind of message.
They've expressed interest in certain educational exchange programs, yes. Though they've made it equally clear they intend to put their own flavor on things.
Mustang nods down into the enclosure.
Look.
Ed looks, standing up on his toes a bit to see, then catches a glimpse of movement, something oddly mottled, tan and brown, a low shape slinking through the ferns. Are those cats?
Of a sort, Mustang says.
Cretan jaguars.
Like Ling's court menagerie of peacocks and tigers. At least these aren't just sitting in boxes or chained up.
Good grief, Ed mutters.
The higher up you go, the more dick jousting has to be performance art.
Oh, yes. Why put on so much of this otherwise? Mustang murmurs back, flicking some of the gold braid frothing out of his epaulets.
And a second later, Hawkeye and Kojak and the rest of them close back around them again, having circumvented the damn photography line. And they all move deeper into the building. This party's big, but not very formal, a cross between the garden gatherings and Ling's court functions. There are kids running everywhere, for one thing, which makes it hard for anyone to get too stuck up their own poles. The Cretans also dress up and down and across the rainbow, standing out even with all the gold and white and teal tiles and bunting and painted archways, and the whole decorating scheme seems to revolve around bringing the outdoors indoors. Giant displays of plants everywhere, making the whole thing feel even more like a festival. Their group starts to get greeted, and shed numbers, pretty quickly. Other Amstrians, people with and without interpreters, a whole bunch of officers in various uniforms. At some point, Hawkeye's absorbed into another group of Amstrian officers, most of them pretty young, bemedaled, and at least half starry-eyed in their chime of, "Ma'am!" And the comms director scattered their hive of minions right at the start, presumably to take up sniper perches at various corners and radio in whenever relevant factions start moving in, like Grumman. Ed keeps an eye out for the Xingyi's military liaison as well, but that cousin of Ling's is 71 and probably sitting somewhere with his wives and his bum leg up. In a few minutes, it's just Ed with Mustang. The Morose, about to peel off to go check if some other general is here, mutters, 3 o'clock, as he turns past them. A tall, lean woman in the Cretan military uniform is coming towards them, pretty directly. Just as she reaches speaking distance, a guy joins her, popping out of the crowd in a way that manages to seem like a dancer's step instead of a high-speed disentanglement. His eyes focus on Mustang. His face lights up. His arms go wide. He shouts something joyful in Cretan. Mustang raises a lazy hand in greeting. The lady says something amused, gesturing equally lazily. Ed realizes the man and woman's outfits match, though she's in uniform. He's wearing the exact same shade of beige, just in a caftan, all covered in gold embroidery to her medals. His turban sporting the same wheel and sword pin she's got at her collar. Then Mustang says something in Cretan, which just completely unseats everything else in Ed's brain. "You speak Cretan?" he says, then remembers what the hell he's here as and tries to paste an appropriately impressed expression on his face.
"Some," Mustang says,
smiling all fake humble smug. "Of course he speaks," the peacock man declares. "Roy-G is most talented, yes, almost as much as my wife." Here he winks broadly at Ed.
"And almost as beautiful, no?"
Mustang says something dry that makes the man roar with laughter. Ed can only assume it's something wittier than, "Bet you say that to all the boys," and less insulting than, "Yeah, your wife's a real looker." She's got a scar running up her left cheek that splits her nostril, almost touching the corner of her mouth, and her eye on that side. "My Amstrian joke improves every day," the Cretan man says, whatever that means.
"Every hour," the woman promises, smiling at Ed. "I see you are not alone this time. General Bagwadi Kakadia is the Cretan military liaison here on detachment with the embassy," Mustang introduces. "Anoop is Bagwadi's husband. Bagwadi, Anoop, this is Edward. He's a very good friend of mine."
Which is even true. Mustang likes her, Ed realizes. That's it. He actually likes her. Like, for real, which has happened all of never any other time they've met any other fuck at these things. It makes Ed look at her again, closer up this time. At first, he thought the uniform just had bulky gray cuffs, but it's not cloth. She's got thick metal bracelets stacked from wrist almost to elbow, glinting dully in the party lights. Something about them catches Ed's eye, has him taking a closer look. They're shaped, not flat, with a pointed ridge rounding each, and there are little nicks and dents all along the edges. She's not moving with any hesitation, but Ed can tell they're heavy. "You fight with those?" Ed asks, before he remembers he's probably not supposed to be asking that kind of question. Kakadya's smile says she's been watching him staring. "It is the traditional woman's weapon," she nods at Mustang's getup, his gloves. "As they say, unarmed is underdressed in Amstrian company." Ed snorts involuntarily, and Mustang laughs. His real laugh, which always sounds kind of weird with its uneven hitch in the beginning. He really likes her. "And you fight also," Kakadya says directly to Ed, still smiling. Then she takes Ed's hands, lifting them in hers. Ed lets her, wary, but aware that it's not going to be cool if he goes all personal space on the Cretian military liaison. She inspects his knuckles. "Though you may like to become less unarmed yourself, you'll need use of your hands your whole life." She lets go of him, though her eyes go to the big scar on his forehead, then the smaller nicks on his eyebrow, his chin, and your head. "Your sport was martial arts for a while, wasn't it?" Mustang asks Ed easily, like he doesn't give a damn, looking back to Bugwadi with a small shrug when Ed nods. "Young men will fight. They grow out of it in time, if they're lucky." Then he returns his smile to Ed, letting it turn sly, reaching out to lift Ed's chin, run a finger just barely along the inside of his collar. "I suppose we could take the scars off, but it's not as though they're detracting any, no?" Ed very nearly bites a new hole in his hand. Kakadya and her husband laugh, though not in a way that says they're aware they're the only thing saving Mustang's life right now. "So it's true? Amstrian alchemy makes even scars go away?" Anoop says interestedly, further indebting Mustang. "We have heard marvelous things, of course."
"Amstrian medicine, yes," Mustang says. "Not very much actual alchemy is applied, not as you'd think it. It's more in the development end of things, creating new medicines and so forth. Having such a robust national dedication to the sciences has done wonders for innovation."
"And constantly having a shit ton of injured soldiers to practice on," Ed says, because he's not in a very helpful mood.
"And the necessity of taking care of our veterans, yes."
Mustang agrees, all but toasting Ed for a fine point well made, clearly suffering delusions of invincibility.
"For scarring specifically, what it mostly takes is time and care, I've heard, and a good surgeon, of course."
It's possible Ed would have found either his limits or his self-control in the next 10 seconds, but it's made moot by Ailey poofing up at Mustang's other shoulder, almost at the same time as another guy in a Cretian uniform zips up to whisper to Kakadya. "My apologies, sirs," Ailey says. "The main envoy..." Mustang says, his gaze fixing somewhere across the hall.
"The ambassador is here. Excuse us."
And he and the Kakadyas both give warm, fleeting, almost identical smiles to Ed as they turn away. The aides peeling off with them, joining a general drift of select people making their way through the crowd. Ed's left to himself, standing still among the golden lights. Something hot and ugly sparks to life in his chest, or maybe just wakes up. He's overwhelmed by the sudden urge to do something stupid. Rip up the central fountain, hurl his glass into the nearest face, stupid. And he's got no right to, even more so than usual, because this is his own damn fault, all the way down. Why should anyone here pay attention to him? He's nobody. Through his own inaction, he's nobody. This is what he can expect, Mustang or no Mustang, for the rest of his life, if he doesn't do anything with it. And it's not like he can do fucking anything about it right now. So he's going to get a grip. He's not a child. He's not going to throw a tantrum out of spite, out of frustration, out of inarticulate helplessness, so stupid it might as well be rage. This is nothing new. It's not like Ling paraded him on his arm ever, only stole moments with him on the sidelines, in the dark. At his court parties, Ed mostly hung around eating, demonstrated the occasional Amstrian dance with Al, or minded one of the little Chong kids while their parents did the rounds. And here's no different. For all, it's going to be a lot of not doing things. Not getting spotted by the Xingyi's envoy. Not turning up in front of Grimmon. Not making a scene. Not putting his fist through any walls. Not making it worse. But the most effective way to stop feeling like this is to find a fight or a fuck. And unless Ed leaves this party, he's going to find neither. He snorts to himself, bitter. Anyone willing to fuck the war minister's boy toy would have to be a Geon, and to fight him, they'd have to add on suicidal intention. And absolutely none of it would have anything to do with Ed himself. If he wants somebody who wants to deal with Ed Elric, he'd have to go find one of the Xingyi's staffers. Only they'd all immediately shunt him to Zhengzhe, who'd grin and slap Ed's back and proceed to interrogate him on exactly what it is Mustang is cooking up here with what Xing knows is his most dangerous and now covert alchemist. And the answer is that Ed isn't cooking up fuck shit at all, because what he's doing here is just running in circles, trying to make Mustang's bullshit make sense. As if it has to make sense. As if there's anything deeper to this than him needing something and seeing a way to get it. The urge to walk out is as overwhelming as it'd been to rip the shirt off. But it passes, and Ed stays. He said he'd do it. He agreed. He told Hawkeye. He can handle this, and he will. In absence of a worse idea, he goes to find the food, which in this party is on little tables arranged in the middle of big floral displays. Ed can tell it's mirroring the way the lanterns are arranged in the big central jungle, and it's a nice detail he'd be appreciating more if he wasn't systematically repressing the urge to smack over every vase and decorative stand he sees. Only then he does see a welcome face. Over by the food, currently fixated on one of the little tiered platters of fruits and nuts and other things. He goes over and nudges her shoulder with his wrist. Hey, Bayleaf. Bailey looks up and around. Oh, hey, Ed. She and Brinley don't look much alike, but she's only 8, and she's aiming the same look of stolid determination that Brinley gives trigonometry homework at the food platters. Can you pass me the pink cup thing, please? Ed passes her one of the pink cup things, taking one for himself. Your family's here? Not Bryn, Bailey reports glumly. Brinley's a good big brother. He's away all summer anyway. Internshipping. I know, it sucks, Ed commiserates. Because with Brinley in the West, he has to get random people to spot him on the bench when Hawkeye's not available. How's your gerbil? Bailey looks up at him, then around, then seems to come to a decision. She takes his hand and leads him out of the main room, down the hallway, only to get stumped by 2 doorways on either side of the hall with opposite symbols on each one. Triangle up, triangle down. Oh, right, Ed realizes as Bailey makes a frustrated noise and starts tugging him in the opposite direction. They've got their double toilet thing going on. I always forget, Bailey grumbles, towing him around the corner and into another hallway, this one lined with giant vases of flowers. Brinley walked in the wrong one once and they yelled like he murdered somebody. Now Mom says he can't come to these parties if he's going to cause incidences. Here. Bailey pulls him behind a vase and opens her little decorative purse. A brown and white gerbil wrinkles its nose up at Ed from between two cabbage leaves and a carrot. I'm not allowed to take it out of the house, Bailey explains, but I think that's a dumb rule. I'm not going to let it run away and get squished. In Ed's experience, arguing to the contrary has no effect until at least one personally experienced incident of squishing. What's its name? Its brain is the size of a pea and it's going to spend its whole life alone with no other gerbils. I don't need to distinguish it, and it wouldn't even know what a name was, Bailey says severely. Names aren't like stickers you put on stuff you like. They mean things. Every time Ed talks to Bailey, he gets a growing suspicion that maybe Brinley fell out a window or two as a child.
What about nicknames and pet names? Your mom calls you Sweetie.
I understand what Sweetie means, Bailey says firmly. She's not just making noises at me. She's communicating. A gerbil doesn't know what my noises mean.
Point there, Ed has to admit.
Does it just sit in your purse, or what do you do for fun at these things anyway?
Bailey sighs hugely, tucking the purse closed again.
We're not allowed to play tag anymore, and Annie and Dara don't even come now. Their summer camp isn't like ours. They go away for the whole month and stay there.
Nobody you like here?
Bailey shrugs. The Cretian kids are okay. They get yelled at more than we do if they mess up their clothes, I think. She wrinkles her nose, not dissimilarly to her gerbil. King's always here, but all he ever wants to do is play Dragonmon.
What's Dragonmon? Ed asks, mystified.
Bailey sighs enormously at his ignorance, takes Ed by the hand again and leads him into a kind of atrium garden, full of more plants and fountains, and a kid in a little miniature suit is cross-legged on the floor. A bunch of little colored cards spread out in front of him. There are several Cretian kids of similar age, crouched across from him. And they do definitely look a lot fancier than any Amstrian kid Ed's ever seen. Though maybe that's because the general approach to children's clothing up to a certain age is largely a matter of cutting the right number of holes in a sack. One of the kids reaches out and touches a card and says something in Cretian.
No, that's an egg card.
What must be king, says, with the air of a businessman presenting the latest quarterly figures. You have to hatch it with an incubator card first, then it can play.
That's Dragonmon, Bailey says, pointing.
Looks complicated, Ed hazards. You don't like it?
You just sit and read stuff and then count, Bailey complains,
finally proving definitive relation to Brinley. It's not even real make-believe. It's a points system. If I want to win points, we can play ball. King and the other kids look up at this.
Oh, hey, Bailey, King says without much enthusiasm, then joins the Cretian kids in eyeballing Ed with a vague, evaluative curiosity.
That's Ed, Bailey tells him. He's my brother's friend. He teaches at camp sometimes. He wanted to see what Dragonmon was.
Oh, King says, correctly interpreting that Ed has an interest approaching negative in the finer points of non-gambling card games. He gives a sigh and gives Ed some incredibly resigned eye contact.
I'm King. Yes, like the president.
Ed can't help but crack a grin every time something like this happens. Henkel got born the year Bradley was made president. Ed laughed himself sick when he heard Henkel's first name.
Hey, I got a good buddy named King.
Everybody does, King says, with all the world weariness an 8-year-old can muster. There's 4 of us in class.
Born in a death year, huh? Ed says, not without sympathy. His own name probably could have been much cooler if only the timeline had bumped a bit. I'm an Edward. King's face screws up in the manner of one retrieving case files from deep storage. Like third grade history. The one before Bradley? Risa, Ed confirms. Did they make you do the flag ceremonies? What? The flag ceremonies, King says patiently. At school. When no understanding dawns on Ed's face, he says, what'd he die of? Ed says, age, I think. Though knowing what he knows, it's highly possible that whenever the homunculi decided was the right time to install their puppet was the time Fuhrer Edward Reese's time, date, and manner of death were decided. Even if the manner was determined to be natural causes, there wasn't much of an in-between period of deliberation for the next candidate. Ed remembers that much. That's good, King says gloomily. If he died of terrorists, nobody ever lets you skip the flag ceremonies. Want to play Dragonmon? Sure, Ed says, deciding he'd rather that than finding out whatever the fuck a flag ceremony is. Truly, he's glad to be a dropout. Bailey sighs enormously and sits down with him, then shoots Ed a hopeful look. Can I do your hair? I'll do it back up after, promise. No, Ed almost says, like a crazy person. The need to keep the braids in, keep them real, coming over him in a wave so strong it's almost nausea. But if he doesn't let her, that's a pretty good indicator he's going to end up doing something breathtakingly pathetic, like sleeping and showering in them for the next 3 days, all while mentally savaging himself for it. Sure. Bailey delightedly scrambles to her knees behind Ed and starts unbraiding. King resumes, or possibly restarts, his game explanation, which Ed half-heartedly follows while wondering if this is what Gion was like as a child, or if this sort of thing doesn't usually come on this early. He gets dealt his hand and doesn't exactly give it his full attention. But between the Cretan kids drawing King into consortium and Bailey explaining, mostly to herself, that she wants to do some kind of fish hair thing, it's not like it matters. Then a flicker of color catches Ed's eye. He leans over as much as he can with half his hair in Bailey's hands, enough to see under the bushes surrounding the base of the fountain. Bailey leans over with him, following the hair and then trying to see what he's looking at. It's a kid, Ed realizes. Much younger, or at least smaller, than King and the others. In a little gold and cream Cretan-style outfit. Curled up and fast asleep. That one's not worried about his clothes, Ed observed. That's Devanch. He's crazy, King reports without looking up. His parents are important, so they won't help if he bites you. They'll just tell you not to let him bite you, so don't let him bite you. Ed wonders if maybe he should go inform somebody. Then again, the rest of the Cretan kids are here, comparing various cards and conferring amongst themselves. So maybe this room is exactly where he's supposed to be. Does he usually fall asleep in the bushes? Yes, King says grimly. He jumps out and bites you. Ed takes the warning. Dragonmon turns out to be not much of a game, though that's primarily because King is more interested in explaining things to the Cretan kids than he is in actual playing. Ed drifts through for a while, until there's an abrupt slap-slap of sandals rushing from one of the halls, and a woman in one of those two-piece and a sash Cretan dresses bursts into the atrium with the distinctly wild-eyed look of someone who has only taken their eyes off their toddler for a second. She whips her head around the room, seeing the kids, but clearly not finding what she's looking for. And on a hunch, Ed catches her eye and points at the relevant bush. The woman scuttles over, peers through the leaves, and sags all at once, relief slackening her whole body. She drops back into one of the chairs along the walls,
nodding exhaustedly at Ed in thanks as she pulls out a fan and fans herself. After a moment, she sits up, says something in Cretian, and beckons, which has one of the Cretian girls going over to her so she can fix the ornament slipping slightly in her hair. The rest of the kids ignore her, focusing on the cards, and she keeps a tired eye on them while equally ignoring Ed. This is not the behavior of someone's important mom. The little Chang cousins all leap up and do perfect little synchronized bows whenever Yao Zhiqi so much as enters a room. So she's probably a nanny, and about as interested in playing foreign language charades for politeness' sake with Ed as she is examining a stranger's foot fungus. Ed doesn't blame her. He's not feeling much up to social interaction himself, and ends up sitting with Bailey off to the side, feeding her gerbil bits of carrot. Bailey's clearly loath to actually finish his hair, doing and undoing it under the pretense of fixing. But after a while, she makes a noise of discovery and pops up in his side vision, a look of hopeful idea on her face. "Hey, maybe if we ask Mom, maybe we can go? You can take me to the park instead?" Ed doesn't think that's going to fly, not least because sunset was like 40 minutes ago. And even if Brinley's mom sort of knows him, he doubts she's going to let her kid leave this party. But either way, he probably shouldn't. "No, I gotta stay. My boyfriend is here." Ugh, applying the word boyfriend to Mustang is the highest stupidity. But it's not like he can tell the truth, and all the other words are worse. Bailey gives him an assessing look, scooting around some on her knees to face him more fully. "Brinley says you don't do boyfriends," she observes. "That's not what Bukta and company say, haha." "I do now," is the best Ed can come up with. "I guess." "Because you love him?" Ed's gonna set his hair on fire. "Because he asked me to be." "So he loves you, but you don't love him," Bailey diagnoses with the air of a seasoned relationship counselor. Then, while Ed's still reeling from that, "Does he bring you flowers?" Ed says, jettisoning all the rest in the face of trying to reconcile Mustang and flowers. "No?" This is not met with approval. "Good boyfriends bring you flowers," Bailey says severely. "I don't really like flowers," Ed says, then seeing her face. "I mean, I like them fine. They just don't do anything special for me. Everybody's different. My ex-girlfriend, she liked flowers okay, but what she really liked was power tools. So I'd get her that, because she wanted those more than flowers." "Oh," Bailey says, mollified. "What does he bring you then?" The gerbil's starting to look dangerously like it's considering the possibility of greener pastures, so Ed occupies himself with herding it back towards the purse with one finger. "Food, I guess." Bailey considers this, but it seems to pass muster. "Do you kiss and stuff?" Fucking hell. Are kids even allowed to talk about this? Isn't she too young? Ed can't use himself or Al or Winry as a benchmark. Granny is a surgeon, and they grew up surrounded by farms. They all knew what sex was by the time they were 5 and helping with the yearly lambing. No, wait, she's just asking about kissing. Kissing is fine for any age, right? They put kisses on posters and in the newspaper and stuff. Ed can handle some goddamn kissing. "Yes? Is he a bad kisser?" "What?" Ed says huntedly. "Is that why you don't love him?" Bailey asks patiently. "Does he kiss bad?" Ed gives in. "Yes," he says. "He's a really lousy kisser." Statistically, given how bad everyone else is, it's probably even true. "Just terrible. I didn't want to bring it up, but..." Bailey nods sagely. "Is he rich?" Ed waggles a hand, grateful for safer ground.
Bailey seems disproportionately dismayed by this. Not even rich? I mean, he's not poor, Ed hedges. He's just not, like, rich rich. Maybe he shouldn't be evaluating on a scale on which one end is occupied by Ling. He's rich enough, I guess. You need to dump him, Bailey says very seriously. He's gonna become a stalker. You're gonna have to hire lawyers and security and not go out for weeks and weeks. Ed has to wonder just what the hell they're being told at the Barakchan household. Though this sort of thinking is explaining a lot about Brinley's diligent abstinence. It's not like that. He catches the words even as they form in his mouth. But for a dizzy moment, he thinks he's about to just spill out all of it. Say, no, you got it wrong. I lied. It's me. I'm in love with him. To a fucking 8-year-old. It's even closer to the surface than he realized, catching him like this. Closer to the bone. He's got to get a fucking grip. Oh, he's with the kids, someone laughs. Bailey instantly scoops her gerbil in her purse. The Cretan kids all look up, hop to their feet, and bow in impressive unison to the group that's wandered into the atrium. Oh no, now don't let us interrupt, the woman in the lead says, which has King giving a hopeful glance between the Cretan kids and his cards. We're just here to find Ed, right? It's not a very big group, but they're all very distinct. They're all young. A couple younger than him, even. And a few more, at least trying to look it. Definitely all younger than all the established spouses back in the ballroom. And it's not like they're dressed to match or anything. But there's a uniformity, nonetheless. A sameness in the carefully perfected look of people who've identified a certain mold and then spent thousands to exact themselves into it. There's a lot of tousled blonde hair. One of them is wearing the same necklace Ed keeps seeing on those fancy jewelry billboards downtown. This, Ed realizes, is his demographic. You don't have to feel like you couldn't join us, says one of them, in a tone that says if he didn't feel that way before, he should start now. Oh, Liz, stop. One of the lone, dark-haired ladies says, with that particular bright laugh women do, to warn you that they're not fucking kidding. Ed, I'm Marta, honey. We saw Roy all cornered by the Cretans and just wanted to make sure you're all right. Ed's not exactly sure what she's getting at, but it's true that he's a grown-ass man sitting here in the bushes playing with the kids. So, yeah, I'm all right. He says, standing up slowly and dusting himself off. I'm sorry, have we met? I know, it's been just terrible, Marta complains, sweeping towards him and actually putting her hands on his shoulders, beaming at him like he's a long-lost twin. We kept telling Roy, bring him around, what are you hiding him for? And now you're finally here and you're all shut up in the back. You don't even have a drink. Come on, let's fix that. Ed lets himself get swept out with the group, probably to the relief of all the Cretan kids and the servant woman, who'd managed to smartly dematerialize at some point while the attention was on Ed. Attention he's still feeling with a discomforting prickle in their midst. His hair's half undone, Bailey's replacement braids unraveling, his rolled sleeves crushing the fabric at his elbows. I just can't imagine why we haven't seen you out sooner, Marta is saying as they sail towards one of the bars, where she leans ahead of him, peremptory. What are you having? Oh, you have to try their tamarind thing. It's so unique. Here, sir! Ed takes the tamarind thing. So, some guy in a bow tie says to him, you're from the East? Of course you are. That accent. And that sets off a cavalcade of everyone saying how they love East, how it's so nice to see it's recovering, how it has so much history and culture and sheep and all the best fermented cactus juice or whatever the fuck. It'd be annoying, but the tamarind thing is nicely sour, so it's not like he has shit to say. Nothing good, anyway. They're not here to talk to Ed Elric, either. He's pretty sure what this is at this point. The regular sugar baby crowd come to haze the new kid off his pedestal. But excusing himself to the bathroom for the next 40 minutes feels too much like running away. And it's not like he's got better company lined up. Or at least not until one girl leans in close and says, conspiratorial, "So, what's it like?" "Huh? Oh, it's good," Ed says, waggling his near-empty glass demonstratively. "No, silly. You know," she smiles, which showcases a fairly interesting mix of fascinated and condescending. "Dating a general?" "The general," one of the younger girls giggles. "He getting you the good stuff?" Another girl, short-haired, nudges him from the other side in a way that could be almost friendly. "He better be, if you've stuck with it this long." "Oh, no, I'm in university," Ed says, trying to sound embarrassed about it, instead of annoyed. "It's expensive." He'd fucking know. He's sunk a big-ass chunk of his state pay into his and Alt's tuition. "Oh, darling," Marta says, with a kind of pitying reproach, leaning herself back into his space. "That doesn't mean you shouldn't get what you deserve." "Unless it costs you canings for Al-Jareb," Bowtie Guy mutters, sotto voice. "Jerome!" Marta protests, amid shocked laughter, smacking his bicep. "I'm just saying," he fends her off, leveling Ed a serious, earnest look. "Don't feel like you need to do anything you're not comfortable with, just because he buys you nice presents, okay? Your own health and well-being are more important." And Mustang's known for playing rough with his toys. Good to know this lot also thinks he's going at Ed's butthole with a belt sander. "I think I'm fine, thanks." "He is the flame alchemist," the woman in the billboard necklace says, arch. "Not worried you're going to get burned." "Oh, I don't know. I get pretty wet," Ed thinks, half hysterical, and has to work pretty hard not to bray aloud. Hopefully the pause comes across more uncertain than unhinged. "He's been really nice?" Laughter all around. "Oh, kiddo," someone says pityingly. "He's an alchemist. They don't do nice." "Oh, come on, Val. He's lasted longer than anyone else." That first woman, Liz, protests in the kind of concerned tone Ed's heard plenty of times from McKenna. "So far." "She's right about the alchemists, though," Bowtie Jerome says. "They don't do anything for free. You never heard about equivalent exchange?" "Good grief. I think the, exchange has been pretty equivalent," Ed says in a brave voice, which really gets them going. "Not a tough crowd, this bunch." "It's all right. We're not gonna say anything," the short-haired girl says, even more conspiratorial. "We all have stories. Hell, some days I think if I didn't have you all..." More laughter. "The point is, you need someone who knows what it's like," Bowtie Jerome picks up. "People who can relate. We're just not living like average people, you know? It can be really isolating. The rumors, everything. Especially if you don't have kids." "Right," Ed says, trying not to roll his eyes. "The rumors. Everyone's heard the stories," another one of them says. This time the combo is both voyeuristic and pitying. "Gymnastics, huh? Bet that helps."
He hasn't made you start inviting friends yet, has he? It's the short-haired girl again. She's got incredibly long eyelashes, clearly professionally done. It's okay. Threesomes aren't that bad. They can be really fun, even, if you pick the right person. Threesomes. For fuck's sake! Ed decides is his safest response here. Trying to look like someone who doesn't fully understand what a threesome is due to the unfortunate prerequisite of being able to count to three. Oh, come on, don't scare him, says a voice behind Ed. Another guy's joined them, a tall, broad man in a head-to-toe black suit with a mane of golden hair and very blue eyes. Roy's a good guy. He's not going to make you do anything you don't want to. He slants a grin down at Ed, friendly, white teeth flashing against his beard. Though I imagine he's already broadened your horizons a little. Because he also thinks Ed just stumbled out of the slow barn is the implication here. Bobby Reinhardt, the man introduces, not waiting for Ed to reply, still grinning friendly as he reaches out to shake. Marta got her claws into you already, I see. Oh, Bobby, Marta says, charmed as a chainsaw revving up. We were wondering where you went. Parole radius opened up finally. Well, these two seem like old friends. Liz, Jerome, Reinhardt says, toasting them with his drink. Katerin, Lou, Ain, Barris, the witch coven now meeting in public. Congrats, and moved right on to a little blood sacrifice. This brings all the attention right back to Ed. Oh, yeah, can't make it to that, he says mindlessly, trying to gauge how far of a sprint it is to the mountain centerpiece hole in the center to tip himself over the railing and, ideally, drown. Sorry and all, maybe next time. This clearly makes Marta realize she's about to lose him, which equally clearly is unacceptable. Which, okay, if she wants to haze him that much? No, no, you're right, darling. We're being terribly rude. Bobby's just got that sense of humor, you know? And it's such a busy party. Nowhere nice to sit and chat, get to know people. No wonder you went off. It can be so overwhelming, another girl chimes in. Especially your first time. So easy to get lost. It can be intimidating, Marta finishes kindly. But we really should get to know each other outside of this sort of thing, don't you think? You can never have too many friends. Ed, quite abruptly, finds himself real pissed. At her, at all of them, at Mustang for dragging him in, and most of all at himself for going along with it. For being stuck here with these assholes, for acting so stupid that he deserves it, for putting himself in a position to even have to see their stupid little power games. The bitch to her right is wearing a necklace off a fucking billboard, for fuck's sake. Al's temple hopping in Jing, learning all kinds of new stuff. Winry's traveling all around Amsterdam, residencing with Automail Studios. Ling's ruling a fucking country. And Mustang's off gallivanting with his important Cretan friends while Ed's here talking to idiots who wear jewelry off billboards. In the shoebox on Ed's nightstand is a solid platinum martingale collar Ling had made for him for his 18th birthday. He probably knows every single Jingyi's delegate at this party by name. What is he doing here? I know, Marta says with a kind of caring firmness. Like Ed's an unadoptable shelter mutt being scheduled for an industrial grooming as a last-ditch makeover attempt. Let's you come out to lunch with me next week. We'll shop some, see the sights. I'll even talk to Roy, darling. Don't you worry. You should have something special for these kind of parties, don't you think? Ed thinks it's get the fuck out of here or get himself arrested again. You know what? I'll talk to him myself. Thanks. Bye, he says, throwing back the rest of his drink. And it's not his most stylish exit. But it's not like he's been in top fucking form this whole evening. This whole summer. Fuck. He never should have let this start. Isn't he supposed to be smarter than this? He's not even doing what he's ostensibly here for. What he promised Hawkeye he'd do. If somebody tries to knock Mustang's head off now, that lot of good Ed's going to be able to do about it way the fuck out here. So far up his own ass he's seeing yesterday's breakfast. Something's got to change. He has to go to Mustang and end this. The thought feels like it kicks something loose, unhitches him. It's not a good feeling, but a relief, still, after so long trapped circling the same drain. He should have ended it sooner. Shouldn't have let it get this far. He'll apologize to Hawkeye, and they can figure something out. Ask Henkel if he wants to spend a month swilling caviar and pretending to be Mustang's next buff blonde rebound or something. Anything. Mustang's right back by the big mountain centerpiece. Kakadia's nowhere in sight, but he's got his head bent listening to Ailey, straightening up as Ed cuts through the crowd. We need to talk. Mustang frowns. What happened to your hair? Nothing. Some kid. Whatever. Look, it's just... Mustang's frown deepens in slight but significant ways, his eyes sharpening, turning more fully to put his back to the party, giving Ed his full attention. Did something happen? Ed opens his mouth and hesitates. Mustang's clearly expecting something along the lines of, Grimmin clocked me, or Halcrow's back, or the Xingyi's envoy outed me in front of 700 people and several major news outlets. Something serious, actionable. Something real. Ed saying, hey, I know we're ignoring my feelings for work, but it's starting to become kind of a thing we can't ignore. Feels indescribably stupid. Pathetic in comparison. But he has to say it. He can't ignore it. It is a problem. He's going to force it out, and Mustang and Ailey, and for that matter, he himself, can just deal. Only then a flicker of movement, cream and gold, catches eye. It's the Deva something kid. He's gotten into the Jungle Mountain pit. Where the giant Cretan cats are. Give me your belt, Ed says. Mustang, at least, is already looking where he's looking and starts unbuckling his saber without a word. Ailey, too, might be a robot, but isn't slow either. He sees his boss removing his belt and starts whipping off his own. The kid down there doesn't look freaked out or anything, but he's like 4, crouching down to poke at the fish in the water. And while the nearest jaguar is some 10 feet away, the kid's got his back to it, and it is looking at him. How the fuck did he get in there? Ed swears, grabs both belts, loops them together, and vaults over the railing. It's not a far drop. Ed doesn't even have to roll when he hits the dirt, though he does startle the kid. Unfortunately, this also startles the other jaguar, which had been crouching in the ferns approximately 15 inches from where Ed's feet hit the dirt. Ed doesn't have a 100% account of what happened next, what with all the speed and screaming. But he does know he shoved at least one of the jaguars into the water with one foot and had to grab the smaller one by the back of its neck because he's still holding it. His other arm is full of Cretan toddler, who's putting far more of an effort into biting him than the jaguar is. This is probably for the best, given the jaguar's mouth is open and panting, and those are some fuck-off huge teeth. So Ed drops that one in the water as well, on top of the first one surging out of it, and hurls the looped belts around the railing. Mustang or somebody catches it. There's a lot of yelling at this point, from pretty much everywhere. And the kid has decided to try bursting into tears. And Ed takes a couple of steps back, gets his run up, and skips them high enough up the wall to grab hold of the belts, anchored around the railing. From there, approximately 17 people try to take the kid from him, but the little asshole is now hanging onto Ed with hands and knees and teeth. So he just heaves them both up and over. And then there's a hysterically shouting woman in his face with a lot of bangles. Just truly an improbable amount. But the kid unlatches from Ed with a siren noise and launches himself at her head instead. So Ed decides she's his favorite person of the evening.
The general pandemonium does not exactly abate from there, but Mustang's hands close over Ed's biceps, drawing him back into his phalanx of guards and aides, reassembling around them in a dark wall that mitigates at least some of the chaos.
"Congratulations," he says in Ed's ear,
though Ed can tell even from behind his gaze is past Kojak's shoulder, on the dramatics of the mom and all her attendants and the wailing kid just outside.
"You even managed to not destroy our belts."
"Oh, go fuck yourself," Ed says disgustedly, shaking out his arm. "He's got little goddamn teeth marks. King wasn't fucking kidding. Holy fuck. You should have at least transmuted some fucking steps out or something."
"And detract from your heroism? You know no one's as fast as you, darling."
And Mustang would have to chalk out the array or have people find out he can clap, which he's just not gonna do. "You're so fucking useless," Ed swears. "Fuck, that better not start some fucking war or something."
"I doubt it," Mustang says, cheerfully even. "I'm fairly sure that's the ambassador's son. It's very likely you'll get some kind of official commendation."
Ed shuts his eyes, wishes he'd executed his plan of drowning himself sooner, and lets his head thunk back against Mustang's chest. Just this once. Fucking awesome.